You're listening to episode 10 of the Talentopoly podcast, where we discuss some of the best links posted on talentopoly.com each week. I'm your host, Jared Brown, and I'm joined by
me, Stephen Dixon,
and Brandon Corbin.
All right, guys, it's time to talk about what you're drinking. Steve, we'll start with you. What are you drinking tonight?
I am drinking the one and the only Nescafe Latte Macchiato, and it tastes so good. Yummy.
Is that going to have enough caffeine in it for you to keep you up during this whole podcast?
Oh, yeah. Jesus. Definitely.
Sweet.
Tastes so good.
So you're operating on like 4 hours of sleep right now, right?
Yep. And coffee has been my best friend throughout the day.
How many have you had today?
Probably about 7, 8, maybe more. I don't know. I can't remember, but I love it. And this tastes so good as well.
Excellent. Brandon, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking water.
Yum.
That is all.
That's all. But in fairness, you've had a couple glasses of wine already.
Yeah,
You did your drinking early.
Yeah, no, we went, hey, we have Olive Garden here in America. And
that's real Italian food.
It's real Italian food, so don't give me any of that. Hey, I was in, you know, I saw pictures of Paris. Yeah, so I already had a couple glasses of wine. So now I'm actually, and it was their house. So here's the trick. If you don't really know what you're doing with wine, like I don't, I just go in and I say, give me your house Cabernet. And it's cheap and it's usually, you know, palatable. And so there you go. You have a couple of glasses of wine, you know, for $10 and boom.
Nice. Little free tip from Brandon there.
Next time
you're going to charge for tips like that.
Yeah.
Are you sure it's not a Sauvignon glass of water?
Sure.
I think Napa Valley region.
Yes, it's a Napa Valley Sauvignon water. Thank
you. It's from 2002. Oh, God, why are you drinking that? Well, I went out and picked up some Twisted Tea before the episode. And
that sounds good.
Yeah.
Is that any good?
I like it. I'm sure it's not for everybody. But
what is it? It's just like it's just a tea with a bunch of alcohol, right?
Yeah, I think it's probably like a malt, what? A malt beer. Ugh. Yeah, it's alcohol. I don't know if there's really tea in this.
An alcohol tea.
Well, they might be using the word tea liberally here.
Yeah, it's not like British tea.
That is absolutely blasphemy.
It's not like PG Tips with vodka in it or something.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what all's in this. I'm sure it's mostly artificial flavoring. But it goes down easy. It's good.
And he gets the job done.
Yeah. And then I chased it with a Red Bull, of course, because, you know, I got to mix the uppers with the downers.
That's possible.
So then you can have it in between a...
Exactly.
Upper downer.
Upper downer.
So in last week's episode, Brandon, we talked about Windows 8. You said you were going to download the preview that night. And yep. I've been waiting excitedly all week to hear your thoughts on Windows 8.
Dude, I'm so unprepared for this. So I downloaded Windows 8, as we just discussed. And I installed it on. I have officially sold my Mac. And I am now a Windows convert.
Are you serious? You sold your Mac?
No, not at all.
I was going to get excited. That'd be a big move.
No, basically what happened is I had VirtualBox. So if you have VirtualBox, it just doesn't work very well. At least that's what I'm giving the credit to, that it doesn't work very well in VirtualBox. So I have no graphics acceleration. Overall, I would say meh. I mean, I'm not a big fan of the two different design experiences, well, you know, where you have Metro and the Natural.
Yeah, how do you get into Metro? I don't even know.
Metro is just there. So when you start up that thing, you've got Metro. And like in the preview that I had, none of the applications are launching. I was able to basically get Internet Explorer to launch and the control panel. What was funny is I had no idea how to get out of the control panel, so I just had to restart the damn thing. But then I realized if you bring your cursor to the lower right left-hand corner, then it kind of start menu pops up, and it's got like a few things to get you back to Metro.
Bring Metro up? Is it like the dashboard?
No, it's just there. Yeah, it's there. You start the computer and you're in Metro. Oh. You are officially Metro.
Is that the way it's going to do it?
I don't know.
And then, when you're in Metro and then when you, for example, launch an app,
Yeah.
It just then goes back to like the whole Windows 7 kind of
thing. No, the apps are going to, if you're especially if you're launching them for Metro at least. If you're launching it, like if you click on Internet Explorer for Metro, I think it's going to be a full screen application. Yeah, and you're going to get back to the, you know, using the same things. But no, all in all, again, I can't say that it was awful. I can say it was uncomfortable. When I did get to the desktop, it was actually, they took away so much stuff that I actually kind of felt lost because I'm used to being overwhelmed with pointless options. But so I felt a little lost, but again, it is a developer preview, and I was running on VirtualBox, so I didn't give it a fair try. But all in all, I the experience that I have does, you know, I'm not going to be leaving my Mac anytime soon, I don't think.
How did you think it was going to work going into it?
You know, I really try not to have any expectations. I thought that it did exactly what you kind of expect if you're used to the Windows 7, you know, sliding boxes thing. So that was pretty normal. I guess I was just kind of underwhelmed, and I didn't have any kind of thing specific I was looking for, but it just didn't do it for me. But again, I think it could be great for a lot of people who have PCs and you know, they need something to make it easier. I do think Metro is going to be great for the mass public. But yeah, for the enterprise, they're going to be like, oh, just turn that shit off.
To me, it just sounds incredibly confusing.
Definitely confusing.
If you're upgrading from Windows 7, and then now you've got this brand new UI. And then, like, depending on what app you launch, it then either launches in Metro or then launches in the normal Windows look.
Yeah.
That's just, like, total...
That's anarchy.
Yeah, well, it's basically saying, look, here's a nice cup of coffee. Taste the coffee. No, wait. You're going to have tea now, okay?
All right.
There's no coffee no more. It's just weird.
Okay, but let's go back 10 years. When we made the transition from OS 9 to OS 10, and we had this great, you know, Aqua interface, and then we'd go launch, you know, Photoshop, and all of a sudden, holy crap, there's the OS 9 bars again.
Yep.
You know, so it again, I think they have the innovation that Apple has? No. But could this be a step into the right direction? Maybe.
So Metro is supposed to become the primary user interface then.
Yeah. Now I'm sure there's a setting somewhere deep in the bowels of the control panel that I got lost in, to turn that off. But yeah, by default, at least this developer preview, when it launches, man, you're in Metro with these awful, awful icons.
Yeah.
They're trying to they like the idea that Apple has, that they do the minimalistic, right. And then they just raped it, right? They just took minimalistic and just like beat it into submission, where we're back in the kind of the caveman era. But again, I guess you got to start somewhere.
I don't know, I think Microsoft pretty much exhausted all their options, and they know that like people are kind of going away from Windows and, you know, towards the Mac because of how it looks, and it's now with the line, it's become similar to an iPad or an iPhone, which they used to. So I think Microsoft's kind of, you know, they're on the last legs in terms of, so they're trying to, you know, just hoping that this might work for maybe, who knows.
Check this out. The Xbox, right? So now if we take away like what our all current existence is, you know, in the next 3-4 years, I'm looking at my son.
Yes.
Who is insanely passionate about the logo he sees every time that damn thing turns on is Microsoft. And if Microsoft all of a sudden, and they are, the next version of the Xbox dashboard is going to be this Metro-style interface, that if we think about it in 10 years, what could happen? You know, I don't know. They might have a stranglehold on the masses.
You know, but the question there is, and then it has to go into all different kind of stats in terms of gaming. Though, but gaming how it is now compared to in the future, there could be a huge possibility that there might not even be consoles, with the fact that, you know, you're getting real great games on, you know, mobile devices like, you know, iPhones or iPads or whatever. You know, there's some real great games out there. So, you know, that might not even be an option anymore, having some sort of
console. I mean, when when you see, like, you know, I see my son play, you know, Angry Birds on the iPhone. He likes it. You know, he loves it. He'll sit there every time he needs to be distracted. He'll go and he'll get on the iPhone. But when he's ready to kick ass, when he's ready to completely engage, you know, he's going to his Xbox. And it would be a PS2 if we got him a PS2 years ago. But I think, like, to the computer stuff, you know, it's really just not that interesting when you are completely immersed going around shooting locusts, you know, and you're with, you know, eight huge guys and you build bonds with them where you just don't get that whole experience, even when you're playing on the iPad, because, you know, it's just not the right thing.
I suppose it depends what games you're playing on. I mean, you know, I've got a PS3 and I've got all the games on there, but, like...
You're not nine.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in terms of, like, the graphics go and the immersion, I really enjoy playing games on my iPad just as much as I enjoy playing games on the PS3. So, but if you said to me, I'm 24.
Okay, so you're old. I hate to bring it to you. Yeah, you are. The stuff that you're building now. Right, the technology that our generation is building is going to be the things that my son's generation, who's 9, 10, those, you know, 13, that generation is going to be really leveraging, you know. So, and if we think about it, in the next 10 years, what happens?
Well, if you said to me 10 years ago, well, in 10 years' time, we're going to have these touchscreen devices that are going to have games that are going to, you know, that are not only going to be mobile phones, but, you know, that these mobile phones are going to have games that can really beat the crap out of, for example, a PSP or, you know, or any kind of handheld device from a specific gaming company, I wouldn't have believed it.
Yeah.
You know, when the whole gaming thing was kicking off on mobile, I was like, but now, you know, for example, there's a game that's out on the App Store, 9mm, and that's just like Grand Theft Auto, and the graphics are amazing, and playing it on an iPad is phenomenal, and
how much is it?
$4.99.
See, that's the best thing about it. Like, who's ever going to buy a Nintendo DS again?
Yeah.
yeah, exactly. But that's what I mean. Games now, you know, the mobile, the whole thing that's happened there, that's really kind of completely redefining the whole gaming industry now. Because, for example, when I look at buying a game for my PS3, I'm thinking, gee whiz, it's going to be like £40 to buy a game.
Well, or I can buy a game for like $9.99. I'll say that there are key differences. That game buy for $40, there's a lot more levels to it, a lot more work generally goes into it. And, you know, for your smartphone costs $200 if it's subsidized, maybe $500, $600 if you're buying it, you know, straight up. And it has to have accelerometers. It's got to have 3G antennas in it. There's a lot of cost involved with things that don't directly render graphics. When you buy an Xbox or a PS3, almost everything inside that box is for rendering graphics and running those graphics quickly. So your dollars are being spent more efficiently for that purpose. I think consoles are always going to they're always going to be able to be more powerful than your smartphone.
You know, it's debatable, but the one thing, the reason why the games are more expensive, you know, like console games, is basically because of the development kits that, you know, the price that you'd have to pay to be a licensed developer and the development, you know, the price that you pay for the development kits. And that's then ramps up the cost of your...
And large teams generally make these games now. I mean, they can cost millions of dollars in production costs. These things are getting up there around the cost of movies. And some of them gross more than your blockbuster movies. You know, your Call of Duties and your Halos, those are huge franchises where they're just making huge money and it costs them $40 million and takes them 3 years to make that title.
So, it's awesome.
It's interesting.
I think you can have both, and I think it's really nice if the smartphone has a companion to, you know, that new Call of Duty game you got. The smartphone has something, and it's all connected through Xbox Live or some Steam or whatever it is.
Not Xbox Live,
right? But whatever it is,
you shouldn't have to pay to play games online.
Whatever it is that's connecting it, it would be sweet to be able to bring your character down. Level them up some more with side games or some activities that are designed for the mobile experience. And then when you get back home, you've got them on your console as well, and you continue playing there. I think there's a lot of interesting, you know, a lot of interesting interplay between a console and smartphones and PC, where you can do your gaming on all those devices.
Mm.
But It would be very sweet to just be able to carry, like, ultimately to have your smartphone be powerful enough that it's your computer, it's your game console.
It will, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
I'm looking at, like, things like tablets as well, and, you know, and I think it's just a space to watch, you know.
Right.
And see what happens.
We'll be able to walk in, we'll never touch our phone, and we'll be able to get all the information that we need. We'll be able to say, oh, put it on that screen, and boom, we're working, we're playing, we're doing whatever.
In
the next 10 years.
Yeah, I think so. So did you guys hear about Netflix, big news, breaking the company into two companies? The DVD portion will be called Quickster. They're just going to focus on DVDs. And then you've got Netflix, which is going to be the streaming aspect, and they're going to be two totally different websites even. You guys hear about this?
Yep.
Well, I'm here in the UK, and I'm still waiting for Netflix, so...
Ah.
So, Quickster, which is funny, because if you go to twitter.com/Quickster, it's Elmo smoking a joint, and I thought that was funny.
Not just that, but the tweets that are going up on that account are hilarious, too.
Yeah, yeah. So that guy's going to get a lot of followers now. Props to him, by the way. You know what? I don't really care. As long as I get my DVDs and I get my movies when I want to watch them streaming, I don't care where it's coming from. And honestly, I don't care that I'm paying $14 a month.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, it's worth it to me. I'm paying friggin' 70 or whatever for cable, and there's like four shows that I want to watch, and I watch 90% of my television on the internet anyway. So when it comes down to it, the amount of content that I'm able to consume for $14 a month, now, you know, with Hulu Plus, whatever I'm paying for them, I don't even know, because it really doesn't matter, because it's giving me what I want.
Right. Yeah, I don't even pay for cable, so I do everything 100% through the net, and then like football games through the HD antenna that I have. But
yeah,
I think if Netflix wanted to charge me $30 a month, if they offered some new plan, they're like, okay, here it is, $30 a month for just streaming. But look, we're going to take that money, and if we can get 1 million of you or 4 million of you to sign up at this price, we're going to take that money and we're going to license great content that's new. That's new release content. Maybe even $40, $50. I would pay for that. That would be amazing.
I would pay 30 is where my break point is. But absolutely 100% agree that, yeah, if they take that money and start and continually bring in great content, that'd be awesome.
So I kind of have them on my like 1 year list here. I'm giving them about 12 months now that I'm paying about twice as much, because I do the two DVDs plus the streaming. So that my bill effectively doubled, you know, around that percentage. And so if they take that money and they put it towards good content, I'll continue to be one of their number one customers. If they take that money and the content doesn't improve on the streaming side, then, you know, I don't have any huge need for it other than my son watches Backyardigans on it.
Yep. I think I'm going to buy stock in them.
Yeah. Yeah, I had some stock in Netflix a little while ago, and I sold it like 8 months ago, probably.
Yeah.
You know, it's taking a little bit of a dip, but it's definitely a good time to buy in.
Yeah, because again, I think they're brilliant. I think if they can keep that kind of core value in the company and maintain that, then we're ready to go. What are you giggling about there, Steven?
Nothing. I just want Netflix to come up in the UK.
Just giggling with excitement about it.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, let's move on to our first article.
We haven't even started?
No, we have not. Yeah. God. We're having good conversation, though. It's great. So we'll get into the articles now. First parts of Google Plus API released. This is... Yeah. So everybody's been waiting for the Google Plus API. You know, really, a lot of people have been emailing Google asking for this. When's it going to come out? They've been pretty tight-lipped about it. And then all of a sudden, they announce, hey, here's some API calls for you. They're read-only. You can't write to the service, but you can get quite a bit of data back from the service through these APIs. And they have, let's see here, you've got the ability to do pagination. They've got, it's all RESTful, which is really nice. They've got some great documentation here. Yeah, if you're interested at all in playing around the Google Plus API, you should definitely go check this out. It's pretty nice.
No, I think it's great that they're finally doing this. That maybe if again, I don't know how many people are actually using Google Plus. Honestly, I haven't used it at all. I mean, other than like right when it came out. But if I can now like say, hey, you know, authenticate your account to Google Plus, and I can kind of see what you're tweeting or you're plusing about, whatever the hell we call it.
Right.
Then, you know, maybe I can use that for, you know, figuring out more about them. So I'm happy that they're doing this, and maybe it'll make more people want to use it.
Yeah, it works with, it's using OAuth 2.0 for the authorization, and you can get the people back through the API and the activities. So I guess that's what
I just want links. I just want links.
I think activities is all of the posts. That's what they call them.
That's cool.
When you say like the first parts of the Google API that have been released, I really think Google just needs to get a bit of a move on, because, you know, I think it just recently, it's only just gone where you can like go to Google Plus now and sign up straight away without the need of an invite.
Yeah, that was yesterday.
So how long has it been out now? You know,
long time.
90 days, they said.
Well, the thing is they need to get a move on pretty fast.
Well, I think they're moving pretty fast, given the scope of this project. This is not a small project.
As soon as, for example, my friends and family move over from Facebook, you know, and they start looking at things like Google+, then that's when I'm going to start using the service. But now that Facebook has kind of jumped on board with some of Google Plus's features, for example, a better way to organize your friends, which has been a huge point of anger for me, because it just used to annoy the hell out of me, you know. So, Google just needs to move faster, basically. You need to roll out things faster.
To me, Google Plus works and acts a lot like Twitter. That's where I see my usage on Google Plus is similar to Twitter, and not at all similar to how I use Facebook, because the public nature of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole execution of Google Plus is far superior than that of Facebook. You know, Facebook just looks dated. Its UI is
It's the UI. The UI is similar to Facebook and better, and I think that draws a lot of the comparison. But the behavior on it, I think, relates a lot more to Twitter.
Hmm. Yeah,
at least in my experience, it seems a lot more like it. And you know, people like Scoble and, you know, a lot of your big social media people are using it. It seems a lot, you know, a lot of broadcasting to the masses.
Your SEO consultants.
Yeah, like people are using this for huge reach, and they're doing it. They're reaching thousands of people through it. I don't think this is much a tool to share that vacation photo with, you know, 10 family members. You can certainly do that. You can make a circle and you can do that. But I think Facebook right now, the way they're set up with the mutual friending and, you know, and they already have that ingrained behavior. I think that Google Plus is kind of smart in that they're not going directly after that. They're making this something that you can use a little more liberally and reach more people with it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the that's how I initially saw Google Plus anyway, is like a replacement to Facebook. And I would like to have what I use Facebook for in Google Plus, simply because I just want to drop Facebook as soon as possible.
Well, you can do it. You can set up your circles and you can share that.
I can't communicate with friends and family because they're not on Google Plus. Not all of them anyway.
Right.
You know, and I don't want to miss out on certain events like, oh, did you check out what happened with this person? No, because I've deleted my Facebook account in favor for Google Plus. And, you know, it's that's one reason why I want to use Google Plus for that. But yeah, like you said, there's a whole different, you know, sites, Google Plus, that can be used just like near enough like Twitter. So, you know, it's got some good points and it's got some bad points. So I just think Google needs to move faster with its roadmap.
Marketing.
Yeah, exactly. They need to move faster with it.
No, I mean, you use it for marketing. It's a phenomenal platform for marketing.
Right. I thought you meant like market it more and put it out there more.
Yeah, no, I'm fine with it now. I mean, I started a group that was dedicated to a new product that I was working on. And they were all like, yeah, let's do it. And so I post some stuff, I get some feedback, and it would be a phenomenal place just to continually keep posting about a specific thing, build a group around this product, and actually have this community that feels, you know, they all knew that that they were specifically selected for this product. So it it's kind of a different dynamic than both platforms, it just kind of depending on what you would look, you know, use it for. So it does, it has kind of a nice combination of both of them. Unfortunately, we'll go back to the, you know, they do need to market it to get the, to get, again, we got to think about those 90% of the people who are actually on the internet and get them on it. And then the rest of us will inherently go where they are.
Right.
You know, think about it. I mean, I really like the, I really like Google Plus, but you know, thinking on, if you look at how Twitter was used originally, I mean, I remember using it years ago with a different account, and it was like, you know, you don't even really have people in the know, you know, using it, like web designers or, you know, people like that. And now practically everybody uses it for any purpose and every purpose. So I think, you know, give Google a bit of time and Google Plus will probably more than likely get to that point.
I agree. Article number two is wireframes. Who needs them? And contrary to the title, this author is actually saying he's making a case for doing wireframes. And his case is pretty straightforward. It's that it's going to save you a lot of time overall during your project. And he kind of learned the hard way. He came through the school of hard knocks and realized that he needed to be doing wireframes after not doing them for a long, long time. And even when a customer of his came to him with some pretty nicely fleshed out wireframes and he saw how they understood their site and it really made the project easier to work on, he still didn't do it. It took him like the, you know, the 10th time, 12th time of seeing these wireframes to finally like say, okay, we need to, I need to sit down, I need to wireframe this stuff out before I actually start doing pixels. And now, you know, he's swearing by it and he's writing about the virtues of doing it. Do you guys wireframe at all?
No.
No. I don't.
Why don't you wireframe?
The reason why I don't wireframe is because I rapid prototype. And the best tool to use for web design is Fireworks. And Fireworks allows you to do rapid prototypes. Because, you know, you just, I don't know, there's a difference between doing a wireframe, knowing where things go, and doing a rapid prototype that just get, you know, get a basic idea of how, where things are going to go, how things are going to look. You know, so it's kind of like a mutual point between a wireframe and the full design. And, you know, of course, that's easily presented and whatnot to the client or whoever you're doing the piece of work for. But I've never really found the need to do a wireframe. But seriously, I know this guy was talking about, you know, you open up Photoshop. But seriously, if you use Fireworks and you get used to rapid prototyping, you're never, ever, ever going to go back to wireframing because it is just a big waste of time.
Do you wireframe, Brandon?
No, I use Fireworks as well. You know, but I would say that I would leave wireframing to the people. If we're dealing with a big group of people and, you know, they need to figure out what kind of content's going on to the site and they need some way to think about it, then fine, wireframe it. But when it comes time to design it out, you know, I'm going to, you know, I might look at it, I might take considerations from it, but it's going to, you know, I'm going to paint. I'm going to have fun with it and just kind of let it come out versus, you know, sitting there and being structured. That's just my personality type. But I agree completely with Steven on Fireworks. And I think a lot of more people need to start leveraging it. I'm trying to get the guys at work to start using it because it's just so much faster. I mean, again, the amount of clicking and layering and all the bullshit that goes into Photoshop, Photoshop's an awesome tool. I love it. I can't give it enough praise for when I need to do photo manipulation. When I need to do UI work, I need something that was built more for UI.
Yeah. I mean, for, you know, further on from that, if you did a wireframe in Photoshop, you're going to have boxes with, you know, crop, you know, lines going across them, and, you know, basic elements laid out. But then when you actually start using that and then start manipulating the objects to create the final version, let me tell you from experience, it is a hell of a lot easier to do that in Fireworks because, you know, Fireworks allows you to, for example, say you create a square box, that's where an image is going to go, and come to the design stage, the box is going to have rounded corners. You can just edit a simple value in the property inspector, and then it's got rounded corners. To do that in Photoshop, you would then have to get a shape, you know, give it the border radius that you'd need, drag that shape, it's more clicks, more time to do things. So definitely rapid prototype over wireframes.
I think that, and maybe this is designer versus developer thing. I'm certainly not a designer, but I think when I'm doing wireframes, it puts me, and I do really, like, I just get a piece of paper and a pen and I do my wireframes on paper. And I'm in a product design mode when I do that. I'm not in any sort of design mode whatsoever. I'm not thinking, you know, I may have some concept of colors, but I really try to keep that in the back of my mind, not really focus on that. And it's more structure. It's, you know, maybe trying a different couple of different ways of doing it. And it's so super cheap to just draw that out with the pen that if I at any point say, you know, this isn't going in the right direction, I just crumple the paper up and throw it out and I can start over.
But we both would destroy you with your pen and paper and fireworks. And that's where, like, again, all you can be doing is just drawing your boxes.
Right.
And it's once you say, because then you're actually seeing it in the form that most people are going to experience it. You know, where on paper, you're looking at a, you know, a real three-dimensional object that has angle, that has all of this. So when with fireworks, but again, I agree. I think it completely depends on the person. You know, some people want to have it all planned out before they start adding color. Me as a designer, I want to just jump into it and really kind of let it come to me. Steven, it's, you know, Steven. And so, but yeah, that's my take.
Okay.
Yeah, and the other thing as well with fireworks is you can create interactive PDFs so that you can create clickable elements in a document.
Oh, that's and nice.
Exactly. So you can create you could create a wireframe in fireworks, okay? But then you can have clickable elements. Send that to a client. They can see how the site's gonna work, and then because you know you're playing around with vectors and all sorts of different things in fireworks, easily editable elements, it then just makes the process, you know, more faster. So
I like it. I like when things are more faster.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing is, just quickly on this is, you know, if you use Photoshop for design, you need to realize what Photoshop is for, and it's in the name. Now, hey, I've been using Photoshop for 10 years to design websites with. I've only just recently switched over to fireworks. Because recently, as of late, fireworks has really become the tool to use for web design. So, you know, fireworks is built from the ground up for web, for on-screen, you know, and Photoshop is mainly should be used for, you know, photo manipulation, as Brandon said before.
All right, let's move on to article number 3. Forget apps, Carbon has built an HTML5 OS. This is posted by Phil Oliver, and this is a recently launched startup at the recent TechCrunch Disrupt conference. What they've done is they've created a web OS built in HTML5, and you can install apps to your desktop and see the icons on your desktop. Click on one of those, it's going to launch that HTML5 app within the this web OS look and make it feel like you have this operating system that can go with you onto any tablet, any desktop, anything that can run HTML5. You're going to have your web OS with you. Did you guys get a chance to look at this?
Beta.
Yes. Yes. So, I mean, you know, I'm not a big fan of this, but it really is interesting to see where people are going and, you know, leveraging the power of HTML5 and other technologies that go under that umbrella. You know, so it's really good. It's really good to see people experimenting and seeing where things go because, you know, the times they are changing, really, aren't they?
But doesn't this seem like a rehash? I mean, this isn't the first time somebody's done a web OS like this.
No, but I mean, you know, you've got, for example, Chrome OS, which is like a web based operating system.
But then not really. It's more browser only OS.
Well, sure, but then it's got various other elements that are similar to what we're looking at right now. The thing is, it's just interesting to see where these kind of things are going. And, you know, it's good if you get more people involved because then we're going to get to a mutual point. You know, one company's going to inspire another and so on and so forth. So,
is this ahead of its time, you think? Or is the time ripe for this?
No, to be honest, I think it's kind of like, you know, I might get a bit of backlash for this, but I think it's kind of like the Linux of the day, you know, because today your main OSs are like OS X and Windows. And this now really is just a little something on the side I mean, I could never, ever, ever use this in a productive environment.
Right.
You know, and I wouldn't feel comfortable buying a device that ran this either. You know, for various reasons that we could probably talk about hours about. So
are you intrigued by this, Brandon? What do you think of this?
Yeah, I mean, we talked last week about having a marketplace for web applications.
Right.
And this is basically what that is. And they've just decided to take the whole design motif, you know, and try to make it. So I think it's interesting. Again, I think it all comes down to client acquisition, that until you can get, you know, enough users on it, it'll be hard to be a dominant player. You know, like Facebook could do this because they have so many users. But I think it's the beginning of something. Will this be the one that ends? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Facebook, and this article on TechCrunch actually talks about Project Spartan, which is Facebook's HTML5 project that, you know, they're supposedly working on and might be announced at their F8 conference, which is coming up shortly. So
did any of you guys hear that in iOS 5 that Safari is going to let you have access to the picture?
No, I haven't heard anything about that.
I heard something about it. I didn't read it myself, so I didn't know if any of you guys could. Yeah,
that would be huge news if they let you do that. If you can reach out to the camera picker through HTML5 through some JavaScript or something, that'd just be huge.
Yep.
So, yeah, I doubt it.
Yep.
I doubt they're gonna do that, but I'd use the hell out of it if they do.
Yeah. While recording this podcast, Brandon's just walking around the room.
Yep.
All right. Our next article is 6 things to do before sending a site design to a developer. And to run through this list quickly, he has provide or rasterize your fonts. That's a great tip right there. Create seamless background tiles. That could be useful. Develop a style guide. Pretty cool. Include rollovers. That's huge. I always want that whenever a designer's giving me his designs. Organize and name your layers is another one I appreciate when a designer does that, because I'm always
Have different pages and not have them be layers, because you're doing this in Photoshop and you should be doing it in Fireworks.
There you go.
Amen, brother.
Fireworks again.
Another brother.
And then clean it up. So clear any guides that wouldn't serve a purpose, and, you know, maybe get rid of that layer that you have hidden or that page that you're not using in Fireworks, and, you know, just try to clean this thing up and give it a, you know, just like when a developer is going to give you a finished product, hopefully they've, you know, made this thing cleaned up, and so another developer could look at it. And be really nice if designers, you know, anytime a designer goes through the steps to do the same thing where it's cleaned up and another designer or a developer who thinks he's a designer can get in there and do some stuff, that's great.
Okay,
Yeah,
well, I was going to say one thing. I just want to bring Fireworks to the, you know, to the fray, to main attention. Another thing you could do before just sending a site design to a developer, if you used Fireworks, is save out a basic, because Fireworks saves out to HTML and CSS. That then could be used as a really basic foundation to developing the site with.
I'll argue against that and say that.
Well, I mean, yeah, you know, the code isn't the best, but what I'm saying is there are, you know, it's a little starting point per se. I just basically wanted to just get another feature of Fireworks out there, because Fireworks. So,
well, they're paying break us it to up, talk break about it Fireworks up and, tonight, right? I mean, hopefully, they're sponsoring this.
Yes,
I'm making money that I don't know about.
I'm wearing a Fireworks T-shirt.
Or learn CSS and break it up yourself and send it to them, so they can actually focus on the code and not the HTML.
Yeah, That's always great. All right, our next article is jQuery Timeliner, posted by Tony Brown. Nice little jQuery plugin that does timelines, both horizontal and vertical. And they these things look slick. This is really a nice look. Did you guys, you check this out, right? This is so awesome.
Talk about it, Steven.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's your endorsement of it. Yeah. Could you do this better in Fireworks, right? This could just all be done. Can we just run Fireworks in the browser? We'll just port that over.
This is pretty damn cool. And Yes. No, I'm clicking through it right now. It actually is. It has, it's kind of like, it's just your traditional slider, at least the one that I'm looking at. And, you know, like where you have the back, you know, previous and forward images. Right. But then it's got a nice timeline that's kind of sliding.
Well, the animation. It's got, yeah, that real nice animation.
And, yeah. I mean, of course, it's not going to work on Internet Explorer, but hey, I don't know. Actually, I don't know if that's true or not. I should actually not say that because I'm very well could.
It's cool, but I will say, it's one of those. It looks cool, and you just want to find a use case to use it. But well, is there actually going to be one? And is this going to be the right integrate? Yeah.
They probably have apps like this already. But I've been wanting to do a Facebook app that might take some of your maybe your most liked posts or somehow significant milestones. If there's a way to dig that out in Facebook and timeline them like this.
Memo Lane.
That's what there is an app for that?
Okay. Memo Lane. It's amazing, actually. And it has all my tweets from back in, 06 and my Facebook post and my Twitter. And it does all of it in a timeline. It's very cool.
Nice.
Memo. Yeah, memolane.com.
All right. Well, our next article is how Batman can help you build apps.
With Robin.
I'm sure Batman can build a hell of a web app. But this is actually
Alfred
talking.
Alfred helps him.
Yeah, this is talking about Batman.js, which is a new open source CoffeeScript framework from the fine folks over at Shopify. And they have created, it has a lot of features like Sprout Core and Cocoa has, where you can do observers, you do a lot of logic in your JavaScript, a lot of the business logic, and you bind to the server side. So you can actually, with only 18 KB is what this thing weighs in at, this library, you can get a lot of what Sprout Core has in it and be using CoffeeScript, which seems like a bonus. Oh, the long sigh.
No, I'm not a fan of CoffeeScript, but, if they can pull that off in 18K, that's awesome. Good, more, and they have a function or an object called Batwatch, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's got to be fun to use this
exactly
stuff. It's got a full MVC stack in it. It's lightweight, has a nice API to it. It does some things that you can't do in Sprout Core or even Backbone. I think that if you're into CoffeeScript and you're especially the syntax is very similar to Rails, where you can do the like current crime report dot address dot number. That sort of thing works really, really well in Batman.js. So if you're accustomed to doing that sort of thing and you've been wanting to do it in CoffeeScript, here's a good way to do that.
And props to Shopify's marketing and technology team working together to come up with this, because it's a great way of getting their brand out there.
For sure. All right, next article, Writing Efficient CSS Selectors, posted by Harry Roberts. And this is... really, the main takeaway from this article is that a lot of people probably think when they're writing CSS, because you read CSS left to right, that that's the way the browser is running CSS selectors. But it's actually not. It runs right to left, which is something I didn't know before reading this article. So if you have an ID like nav followed by the A tag, your browser will actually start by finding all A tags in the HTML, and then it will get rid of any that aren't a child of a element with ID nav. Mm-hmm. And that is faster. That's more performant for it to do. And they have a nice little link that goes to a Stack Overflow discussion if you're wondering exactly why. But it, generally it's because you're going to have fewer, you're going to quickly find all those A's, and then you're going to be able to narrow it down very, very quickly. Say, okay, well, here's the one or the few that I actually care about. So how can you use this knowledge to write faster interpreted CSS? And that's what this article goes over. And it does come with the caveat that you don't always need to be thinking about this, because CSS parsing in browsers is pretty fast already.
Yeah.
And it's getting a lot faster. So, they make the point of, if you're just doing a portfolio website or a pretty standard website, no, you don't need to worry about this. But if for some reason, the business need for your site is that it is super fast and things like this are optimizations you're looking at, then maybe this is something you need to know about and try to practice.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'll leave it at that. If that is something you care about, you can go check out this article and learn a little bit on how to make faster CSS selectors. So our next,
awesome.
Yeah, a little it's a drive-by article right there. No discussion necessary.
Yeah, move along.
Trello is our next article. This is posted by Adam Brown. This is some nice software by Fog Creek Software, and they've come up with a ridiculously simple concept of managing lists, any type of list with any type of item in there, and all the different things you can do with this. They call them lists, and then you have cards, and the cards fit on the list. And you could say, well, I want to create a workflow, let's say, for your company. And so first, you know, let's say a business lead comes in through the sales team. So you one of your salesmen is on the phone with somebody. They take a business lead. They create a card, put it up on this list of leads. Then they, you know, they're talking to the guy. All right, you would like a like online demo. You want, you know, our demo guy to call you up and do an online demo. Great. And they move you then over to the next list of online demos, assign one of the guys that does the demos. He's going to immediately get an email saying this person needs you to schedule a demo with them. And it's just all done through these lists. And you can use this for pretty much anything you're interested in.
It's I think it's a great idea. I think it's fairly abstract, and you know, the adoption is going to be hard, is my guess, just because it does require, you know, some serious nerdism to like get boned up about building workflows based on lists and cards.
Right.
But nonetheless, it's a very cool product. So on the geek cred score, it's very high. You know, it's got a very interesting, clean interface, and yeah,
cool. Very drag and drop friendly. You know, mm-hmm. You drag a card over a list that already is full of cards, and then one of the cards moves out of the way. You see the outline of where that card's going to drop in. It looks really fun to use.
So, how would this compare or be a better, maybe alternative to Basecamp?
I think Basecamp is more trying to be a repository for stuff. Documents, photos. Yes, you can do lists in there.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I use Basecamp to, you know, liaise with clients and, you know, business associates and so on. So,
this is probably really competing with it.
I mean, the UI looks pretty cool, so.
I'm personally not a huge fan of Basecamp. I don't have anything against what they're doing. I've just found that companies that and clients that I've worked with who do have Basecamp accounts, I think 37 Signals is excellent at getting you interested in buying into their product, getting your credit card info. And if you keep using it for months or years, then I'm sure you can get great value out of it. But I think most of their customers, at least in my experience, the customers I've seen using it, their usage of it drops off dramatically pretty quickly. And I think Basecamp is only as good as what you put into it, as is the case with this Trello. But Trello, this seems much lighter weight because all you're doing is lists that don't require a lot of text. You don't have to do a lot to make one of these cards. You're basically just ordering things and organizing things, and that's a really lightweight set of actions to be performing versus a lot of the stuff you have to do on Basecamp to drive great value in it.
Yeah.
So cool. I like this. I use Notepad at work on Windows and keep my to-do list for the day in there. Yeah, it's super lightweight. I use TextEdit on my Mac. I've used Remember the Milk. I've used a lot of different to-do things. I have the Wunderlist app that looks really cool, but I've never actually used it on my Mac. For me, just the simpler the list functionality is, the better. And about the only feature I'm really looking for that I can't get with TextEdit and Notepad is syncing. To be able to sync it through the cloud is really what I'd love. And this thing seems to do that.
Have you ever tried the Corbinizer?
Mm-mm.
It's a Corbinizer. Corbinizer.com. And it is the easiest task manager in the world. You print it out and you fold it.
And throw it away.
No, and you keep it on your person and you write your shit down and you'll do it about 1,000 times faster than on your iPhone.
Totally.
Incorrect.
No, I'm telling you, man, I've got like a stack of these things. You can tell me, hey, Brandon, what was your to-do in 2 years ago? And I can go break out my Corbinizer.
Like run a search.
Do it. Yeah.
Dude, but you know, for some reason, there's been a huge fire and it's all burnt. Oh.
Yeah, but then they're my to-do, so who cares?
Yeah, from 2 years ago.
You might need for some certain reason or other. That depends on you winning a lot of money by a rich man.
All right.
Who knows?
Article number 9, kerning.js, posted by Polly Ivanova. This is a JavaScript library that lets you do have great control over your typography in your website. Using standard CSS, you can style, transform, and scale your web type. And you can do things like increase the kerning on a per-letter basis. You can change letter size per letter, colors. You can do some really neat stuff with some pretty lightweight CSS using this.
And yeah, this is pretty cool. I mean, I'm definitely going to be playing around with this. Now, you know, performance-wise, have we seen anything like how big the library is?
Don't see that. I couldn't imagine it being that large.
I mean, but it's kind of crazy. Like the letter size attributes that you can add to your CSS. Again, I'm not a huge fan of non-standard, but, you know, where you have like make the fifth character, you know, 0.5. So it's right. Got some pretty cool stuff in it.
Well, they did it for the and symbol and the hello and goodbye example.
Yeah,
and I think it works there. I like that. You know, you but might have that
per letter. I mean, where you can say, okay, every S and every P, make it this color. I mean, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, you're probably not going to do that. But you could if you want to.
Sure.
And this will make it super easy. It's just more JavaScript for you to pull in. Yeah.
Is it useful?
Not at all.
But this is, I think, the beginning of having more control over your type on the web. This is something that people...
But
This is a need. And this may not perfectly fill it, but we need this.
Really?
I think so.
I've been doing fine for the last 10 years without it.
Well, you know, I'm sure people said that when they used like CSS and CSS2, but, you know, it gets better. I like the idea of having more control over this. We've had things like letter type, you know, all of the different, you know, font kits a while. And now to be able to do it more natively and not even have to pull in specialized fonts or do a bunch of different spans to be able to do this in CSS, I think is good. And not have to do crazy extra markup in your HTML. But I don't do a lot of custom lettering right now, mainly because there's not a lot of easy ways to do it. And I just don't spend much time. I said it's Helvetica and forget.
Having something like this, compare the size of this particular file, for example, compared to maybe an image that could easily replace that.
Well, but you want to get away from images.
Yeah, but I mean
nobody,
I don't know.
It's not, nobody wants to do images.
I think we're trying to, people are trying to just fight over like a rock. You know, there's a little rock on the floor. No, it's my rock. No, it's your rock. I don't know. It's a pointless exercise, in all fairness.
Well, have you checked out lettering.js?
Lettering.js.
Yeah, this is jQuery plugin. You can do a lot of cool web typography stuff with it. They have things like fit text is based on that, which allows you to change text size, especially good for responsive design.
Yeah, but
there are a lot of cool text manipulation libraries using CSS and JavaScript out there. I don't think this stuff's going away. I think that we're moving towards a future where you have more control over your type on the web. Yeah, that's my guess. That's my opinion. Maybe wrong. All right, let's move on to our last article. Tiny Proj. This is a mailing list of small projects for developers and designers. This was started by Kyle Brager of Forest.com. And the concept behind this is to send out an email once a week that you can subscribe to as a developer or designer that will list projects that are small in size. And by small, it's a project that will only be a couple of weeks in length, maybe 3 weeks max in length, and no more than $5,000 in payment. The list is curated, so Kyle or somebody on the back end is approving of the projects that are going to go out every week. And it just comes in as this unobtrusive email instead of having to be a, you know, this is really the big thing is why is it not a website that you can go to and check whenever you want? And from what I've seen, the response is that it's less intrusive for it to just go out once a week, and you don't have to think to go to the site. The email will come to you. You can just trash it if there aren't any projects in there that interest you.
Groupon. So,
something you guys would subscribe to. Do you think this sounds cool? Or
I think it's
Same. Yeah, I think it sounds really good, yeah.
And it's a curated list, so hopefully the projects would be of high quality that are being, you know, prospected around in there.
And it looks like it'll be $25 if it's selected.
Right. So it's not too pricey to get your project on the list.
It's just, okay, so what's the next step? For example, okay, so I want to work on a project. What do I do then when I get the email? I'll click a link and then...
Yes, you click a link, and as far as I understand it, you can get more details about it by clicking on the link, and then you're going to quickly get in touch with that person directly. It's up to you to contact them directly.
But what happens if someone else goes for the same job?
Well, I think that's probably what the people listing the projects are hoping for, is that they'll get some interest, you know, among several people, and then they can evaluate which person they want to select to do the project.
Hmm.
That's how I believe it works.
Okay. Well, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Especially with it being from Forest as well.
Well, according to their page, they have over 4,800 people that have signed up to, you know, that have subscribed to this weekly email. So it's got pretty good traction.
Have they subscribed to take on projects, or they have projects?
No, they've subscribed to receive the email every week.
Oh, there you go.
That's all that is.
So what was the number again?
4,800.
Sweet. So if you want to get a project on via the site, you're going to be competing against 4,800 other people.
Well, I don't know how many
projects.
Yeah, potentially. Actually, potentially.
Wait a minute. But then, as a as a project manager, you've just issued out projects, and your inbox is just going to get flooded. So then, how will you be able to? Is there going to be a way? Is this going to be a curated list? And I don't know how's it going to work.
Because it'd be interesting. After this is out for a couple of weeks, it'd be interesting to kind of know some average stats of how many people get in contact with the people posting projects. I couldn't imagine that they're going to get completely flooded, because you have designers, developers, copywriters. You've got a diverse crowd subscribing to the email. Sure. You know, usual conversion rate is in the single digit percentage on people clicking through and being interested on things. You know, you'll probably be somewhere around there. I don't think you'll get 30% of 4,800 people interested in all these projects.
It depends.
You're not going to get hundreds of people emailing you, but maybe that, I mean, if that's what you want, hopefully that would happen.
Maybe there might be an option in settings like, that's the thing. Maybe you might have to fill out your profile, let's say, with certain details, and then, you know, like for example, how you list an eBay item, you can select who can see that item and the people who can buy that item. Maybe that's what they'll do with this, and you'll kind of set things in your profile that will allow you to apply for certain, you know, projects. So maybe like only get people who've been members on the site for like a few months, or people who've done X amount of projects through this website who can, you know, apply for this job, apply for this project. Maybe something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure if you suggest it, that they will consider it.
But it definitely sounds awesome, so I'll be checking it out.
Right on. All right, well, awesome. That's it for our show this week. You can tweet us anytime at Talentopoly. And if you use Instacast or iTunes, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, please. You'll be helping us move up in rank and one day take over the tech podcast world. And our podcast regime will reward those who've subscribed with a version of Android that boots into a browser that can only load Talentopoly.com. We'll call it Honeycomb Ice Cream Cupcake. Thanks for listening.
Mercredi, mercredi, un, deux, trois. Mercredi, mercredi, je ne sais quoi.